From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
They have attempted to infiltrate us. They have practiced intensive dirty tricks against us. They have kept us under off and on surveillance. It's like the 60s all over again. All of those measures have failed, and Plowshares continues, not only abroad, but here in the United States.
An extended conversation with veteran peace activist Philip Berrigan from behind the wall at the Petersburg Federal Prison in Virginia. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today in our Memorial Day special, we will replay an interview with Philip Berrigan, one of the founders of the Plowshares movement, a movement that began in 1980 with Phil Berrigan, his brother Father Dan Berrigan, and other religious activists who went to the King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and hammered on nuclear weapons with the philosophy of turning swords into plowshares. We'll start by bringing you rare footage of a Plowshares event. It actually took place just over a week ago, and we were able to record that protest at Andrews Air Force Base.
Brothers and sisters, let us disarm these gods of metal into plowshares.
Metal. We're disarming them just like we hope we would disarm the gas chambers in Hitler's Germany.
These
are weapons of mass destruction. We are followers of Jesus and we call for an end to the arms race.
My name is Father Frank Cordero. I'm from Iowa. Speaking for Christ, the Prince of Peace.
What's your name?
Father Larry Moreland from Bloomington, Illinois.
What's your name?
My name is Kathy Shields Boylan, and I'm from the Dorothy Day Catholic Worker in Washington, D.C.
What's your name?
Sister Carol Gilbert from Baltimore, Maryland.
What is this banner you're holding?
The middle, and we're going to start reading our statement. Gods of metal. Gods of metal plowshares. Do not turn to idols. Do not cast metal gods for yourself. I am Anawe, your God. You shall not have other gods before me. You shall not carve idols for yourself.
Everybody down the ground.
You shall not have any gods. Have you? Or on the ground. Or the floor of the water.
Down on the ground, sir. Down on the ground.
Down on the ground. Or worship them. They will hammer their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not be saved.
The soldiers are telling the protesters to get down on the ground as they push in there. The soldiers are pushing us back as well with the entire crowd as they handcuff the protesters. These are Plowshares activists, and they start to take them away. The crowd is backing off. We're back with the crowd, attempting to record what we can. And there you have it. Those are the confiscated tapes, Democracy Now! Tapes, of a Plowshares action that took place this past Sunday at Andrews Air Force Base. The five protesters, the two priests, the two nuns, and the religious laywoman, were arrested. They were taken away in handcuffs. But we also want to report that we, as journalists, were arrested. The military took us away. They searched us. They put us in handcuffs, made us sit on the ground of the airfield, and took Jeremy Scahill, the Democracy Now! Producer, and I away in military police cars to the military police station, the Air Force military police station, where they put us under armed guard for 6 hours incommunicado. And we demanded to speak to a lawyer, to our radio network, to Pacifica. They said we wouldn't be able to until they brought in the FBI, military investigators, the JAG, and the Air Force Office of Special Investigation. They confiscated our equipment, then gave the equipment back, took out the heart of that equipment, which was our tapes and our film, and said we had no right to them, or we had no rights, the Air Force told us, once we passed on to this military base. Well, our lawyers this week demanded the tapes because they were illegally seized, and because, I have to say, I think the power of the people, we got those tapes back, because ultimately, so it was the innumerable calls of Pacifica listeners all over this country to the FBI that those tapes ultimately were handed over. But we have one more thing to deal with, which is that the Andrews Air Force Base issued both of us a ban and bar order saying we could not return to Andrews Air Force Base for 2 years. This is an outrage. We are reporters. We are entitled to cover protests and do our job, which is be reporters. Now to our interview with Philip Berrigan.
Hey, did you get the rest of your herd out?
Did you get the rest of your herd out? No, we're not on a farm. Those are guards talking about their prisoners.
Yeah, they came out this morning.
I guess they're out. The captain signed it, took it to say.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with my co-host for today, Jeremy Scahill. And we're sitting in the federal penitentiary in Petersburg, Virginia, with Philip Berrigan. He was the first Roman Catholic priest imprisoned for political reasons in the United States. He was first jailed in 1967 for destroying draft files in Baltimore. In 1968, he was arrested for burning draft files with napalm in Catonsville, Maryland, in a case that became known as the Catonsville Nine. Berrigan was one of the founders of the Plowshares movement, named so for the prophecy of Isaiah in the Old Testament, calling for people to beat swords into plowshares. The first action of this movement happened on September 9th, 1980, when Berrigan, his brother, Father Daniel Berrigan, and six others entered the General Electric plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and hammered with household hammers on Mark 12A nuclear warheads. Phil Berrigan is now 74 years old. He served more than 10 years of his life in prison for over 100 anti-nuclear actions since the Vietnam War. He's currently serving a 2-year federal prison sentence for hammering on a nuclear destroyer, the Aegis Destroyer, in Maine last February. That's February of 1997. And here we sit in the visiting room of the Petersburg Federal Penitentiary. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Philip Berrigan.
Thank you, Amy and Jeremy.
Before we talk about what brought you to this prison for your latest sentence, we wanted to find out about the latest information that we've heard. We understand that you've just come out of 11 days of solitary confinement, and that the warden has told you that you've been stripped of all visiting rights, including your immediate family, for the remainder of your prison term, which is about a year. Is that true?
Well, 10 days in solitary confinement, and the warden said that visits would be suspended for a year. And, of course, that will cover the remaining time I have here because I'm slated to be released in November, November 20th. So that's what it amounts to. And the thing that I find especially reprehensible about it is that it draws my family and friends into a punishment that I'm willing to take, unjust though it is. I didn't deter Mayred McGuire from doing a little action here, and that's what I'm being punished for.
Can you explain what actually happened? Mairead McGuire won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1976 for her peace activities in Northern Ireland. I understand that she nominated you and your brother Dan Berrigan for the Nobel Peace Prize this year, and then came to visit you, and after you were taken out, she refused to leave.
That's substantially it. She was lecturing here in this country and told me that she had considered doing this action for a couple of weeks before she came. Of course, I had veto power over it. She didn't want to bring any punishment on me. I somewhat disregarded that, even though I suspected that there would be some punishment connected with it. I told her to follow her conscience, and she did, and was arrested, spent the night in Richmond City Jail, and then was released the next day. Then she went about her lecture business, I think, down in Texas, and then Seattle and Chicago.
So she stayed here after you left, and eventually was taken away, strip searched, held for 26 hours, went to a court where she told the judge that she was protesting your incarceration. The judge said he was not fond of the Berrigan brothers, that you had been in his court before, but that she was free to leave and that he was dropping the charges. And that action is what led to the warden of this penitentiary keeping you here, basically, though not in solitary confinement, in isolation from your family and friends for close to a year.
Not the warden especially, because they're, it's a matter of delegated power. And a guy came in from Region, and he constituted a solitary court. And he told me that there were certain options open to him regarding punishment. And I said, well, you know, I've paid my dues. I've been in solitary for 10 days. And Ms. McGuire spent an overnight in jail for this action. What more do you want of us? Well, he said, it's not as easy as that. I have to follow certain procedures, and the options open to me would have to do with putting you back in solitary for an indefinite time, or taking 27 days good time, or suspending your privileges like mail and canteen. So he said, step outside, and I'll consider what I'm going to do. So I went outside for about 5 minutes, and he called me back in. He said, your visits are suspended for a year.
Is it true you refused to sign a piece of paper, denouncing McGuire's action?
Yes. I think if I had agreed to something like that, they would have shoved something toward me to sign. But as it was, I said, no, she'll make up her mind herself. She'll follow her conscience again. And I won't suggest anything to her. Let her handle her own situation.
Phil, beyond your having been in solitary confinement for 10 days and your being isolated from your family and friends right now, there is a new trend of action on the part of the government that is facing Plowshares activists as they are coming out of prison, and that is that they're not being allowed to return home. Michelle Nar-Obed, Plowshares activist from the Jonah House community, is banned from returning to Jonah House, as is Steve Baggerly of the Norfolk Catholic Worker. Could you talk about this latest string of actions on the part of the government against Plowshares activists?
Yeah, what the government is trying to do, because every other answer they've had regarding Plowshares has been frustrated. Let me spend a moment on those measures taken by the government. They have attempted to infiltrate us. They have practiced intensive dirty tricks against us. They have kept us under off and on surveillance. It's like the 60s all over again. All of those measures have failed, and Plowshares continues, not only abroad, but here in the United States. There have been about 56 or 57 of these disarmament actions. So what they're trying now is to break up our communities, you know. And they're taking it upon themselves to add to the sentences of these activists coming out of jail, who not only nonviolently stood by for arrest, but also went to court nonviolently and did their best to battle with these disasters that we call courts. Because they're all perfectly identified and aligned with the military and with the government. So now they're trying these measures. And the first case, that of Michelle, She suffered very deeply in jail because of separation from their little daughter and from her husband and from the community. And she didn't feel herself capable of taking on this immediately after release from jail.
Now, we read court documents, actually they were from the probation department, stating that the reason that Michelle Nahr-Obed is not allowed to return to Jonah House, which is also your home, is because there's, quote, ongoing criminal activity there and a convicted felon living there, namely your wife, Liz McAllister.
Yeah, all of that is true from their standpoint, sure. Yeah.
Why is your wife a convicted felon?
She was convicted for Plowshares action against B-52 bombers that were being deployed to Europe during the whole Euro missile scare in the mid-80s. She disarmed a bomber that was being re-systemized with air-launched cruise missiles and got 3 years for that from the federal government.
Well, this is really quite something. I mean, it might be shocking for people to understand that the two people Jeremy just mentioned, Michelle Nahr-Obed and Steve Baggerly, will not be allowed to return to their homes, which means that either they cannot reunite with their husbands, wives, and children, or in the case of Michelle, for example, her husband and child have to leave Jonah House in Baltimore and live elsewhere. So there, it sounds like, and according to Senator Barbara Mikulski in a letter she wrote, they're trying to destroy Jonah House. They're trying to end this community that has lived there for more than 20 years.
That's pretty much it, Amy. Greg and Michelle, of course, Rachel, all were members of our community. When Michelle came out of jail in early November, they had to be uprooted. She couldn't come back to Baltimore at all. Had to head directly for Norfolk, Virginia, where they had to find an apartment. They weren't allowed to live at the Catholic Worker in Norfolk, which was half a mile away. All of these things were imposed by the government. Otherwise, the threat of being violated and sent back to jail was, of course, very, very clear and present.
It seems amazing that they can do this after you serve your sentence.
Yeah.
We're talking to Philip Berrigan. Unfortunately, we're talking to him in jail at the federal penitentiary in Petersburg, Virginia.
Now, Phil, we've been talking about some of the treatment that you've received in the prison here and some of what may face you as you get out and some of what has been facing Plowshares activists as they've gotten out of prison. But I'd like for you to take us back to February of 1997 and tell us what it is that you did that got you into prison down here in Petersburg, Virginia.
Well, people ask very, very commonly, why did you go to Maine? You know, of all places up near the Canadian border, what have you? And we said because of what they build there. And there are only two places in the country where they build these fearful ships, which the Navy boasts at large. They're the most powerful ships afloat because of their armaments, which are dual capable. They can be either nuclear or conventional. And they have already been used against Iraq. So we found them to be a highly political target, and a great deal of consideration in the Plowshares community goes on about what is a relevant and a political target, because the scene shifts with these hellish weapons all the time, you know, and diplomacy is hitched to the weapons, the technology. So we finally decided to go to Maine.
We're talking to Philip Berrigan. We are guests of the U.S. government, I guess you could say. We're sitting in the visiting room of the Petersburg Correctional Institution, which is a federal penitentiary. It's not minimum security. Philip Berrigan here for an action he was involved with two Ash Wednesdays ago, where he hammered on a nuclear destroyer in Maine. And we're going to find out just what that action was about when we come back after stations identify themselves. We're also just going to talk a little more about this form of resistance that Philip Berrigan, as well as his family, has been engaging with for many decades. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
War. A young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I killed the sheriff engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big war. I saw many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the war.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill, and we're sitting in the federal penitentiary at Petersburg, Virginia, talking to Philip Berrigan. He is here incarcerated for a two-year sentence. We're going to find out just what he did in a minute.
That morning of Ash Wednesday, in the pre-dawn hours, you were actually able to board an Aegis destroyer, which is NBC, as they call it, nuclear, biological, and chemical capable. Could you tell our listeners what it is that the six of you did to that Aegis destroyer?
And how you got on the ship?
Well, they had a catwalk going right up to the stern. And that was our experience with the Gettysburg, too. Actually, when we went aboard the Gettysburg about 2 years previously, we could have gone into an orgy of destruction, because there was nobody aboard the ship, and it's a $1 billion ship, just as this Aegis destroyer was. In any event, they had a catwalk going up to the stern, and there was a security shack right on the stern near the helicopter pad. And there were some young sailors, including a warrant officer. And three of us were pretty well immobilized immediately, you know, because the young sailors, the ship was fully occupied by about 230 sailors, and they were all over the stern of the ship. So I was stripped of my hammer and blood, and two of our number got through to the missile hatches up on an elevated foredeck and began to belabor them. And Steve Kelly, a Jesuit priest, worked his way down into superstructure of the ship itself and finally ended up on the bridge. And there you have a lot of sophisticated cybernetic technology. And he began to disarm that.
What do you mean by disarm?
Well, he put it out of commission. Yeah, he disarmed. He disarmed the ship because the ship could not be operated the way it was.
By hammering on it?
Oh, yes, and by pouring blood. And, you know, you're dealing with sensitive circuits and what have you, and blood has salt. And he disarmed the ship, and then they damaged the missile covers of the Tomahawk cruise missile, which, of course, are flush with the deck. Yeah. And the sailors went berserk because the general alarm was sounded, and they were running around with guns and shotguns and threatening us with it and threatening us with the butts of the shotguns. And that was pretty much the action. And then the bat... police came around and arrested us and took us to their station.
Now, originally, when you were arrested, you were charged with state charges, and the judge that you went before on your arraignment called you the conscience of a generation, and shortly thereafter, those charges were dropped and the feds picked up the charges. And you were tried before U.S. federal judge Gene Carter in a trial that you referred to as a kangaroo trial. Could you explain to our listeners why you referred to it as a kangaroo trial?
Well, unabashedly and shamelessly, in federal court, anything that has to do with putting the government or the military on trial or try to any attempt to bring them to accountability is suppressed. And here I'm speaking about constitutional law, because international law is protected by our Constitution, Article 6. Also the Geneva Conventions, also the United Nations Charter, all suppressed. So we weren't allowed to deal with these aspects of the law, and we weren't allowed to tell, because of that, why we did it. The only thing we were being charged with was having done it, something that we admitted to. So all sorts of ironies and paradoxes operating here. We did the best we could, and then we pulled off an old IRA trick, which is fairly common, viewing the court as illegitimate and turning your back on it after reading statement of explanation to the audience in the courtroom. So that's how we terminated the trial.
And this was where in Maine?
At the Bath Iron Works, the shipyard there at Bath, Maine.
I just wanted to take you back through the trip we took today from Washington, D.C. to visit you in this Petersburg prison. After we left Washington, D.C., we went down 95 South. We passed the Pentagon, the Lorton Prison of Washington, D.C., Quantico Naval Base, where the Marine Corps is based. We went to Garrisonville. We also saw the Norfolk Naval Shipyard on our way down to visit you, which is one of the places you had a plowshares action. The Richmond National Battlefield Park was next, as was the Petersburg Battlefield. This really was a kind of map of events and places that you have fought against for more than two decades.
It's too bad the soil couldn't cry out with the blood shed upon it, because, as you know, Virginia was heavily the site of many fierce Civil War battles, you know, and have given, of course, a large percentage of their young males to the nation's wars all the way through, including the Desert Storm in 1991. So this is kind of select territory here.
Can we go back to your first action, the first nonviolent action that you engaged in that meant that you would spend time in jail? It was actually before, and I know we're coming up on the 30th anniversary of the Catonsville 9 case, when you burned draft cards in Catonsville, the Baltimore 4 case. What was that? And why did you choose to begin this path?
Well, I had attended an SDS meeting in Chicago called by Sidney Lenz, who was the old labor organizer and author, and who did such marvelous work against what he called a doomsday race, which was a nuclear arms buildup, Soviet Union. So I went out to Chicago and sat down with Hayden and Greg Calvert and others, and they were concentrating on selective service. And that made sense to me. They were stopping selective service buses. They were chaining wheels. They were regaling young draftees about refusing to go, on and on and on.
This, of course, during the Vietnam War.
That was during the Vietnam War. This would be 1966, roundabout in there. So I came back, and we had tried a whole variety of things against the war. Legal measures for the most part, though we had committed civil disobedience down at Fort Myers, Virginia, which is where the Joint Chiefs of Staff live, many of them, right next to Arlington Cemetery. So we had tried a variety of things, and they were all fruitless. So we thought that we ought to move from dissent to resistance, and we ought to focus on selective service. So we consulted a very fine criminal lawyer down in Alexandria, Virginia, and told him about our plans and confidence, and he was aghast. He says, God, don't do that. He says, these guards are armed now. And we knew that because we were constantly casing out the customs house in Baltimore where there were 18 local draft boards housed. We knew all of that. The guards were armed. He says, if you stay in the building overnight, then they have the option of shooting you. What's more, they'll throw the book at you in court. So he said, why don't you pour blood or something like that? He says, it's already been tried. There was one case up in Boston, and so we finally decided on doing it.
We're talking to Philip Berrigan. Unfortunately, we're with him at the federal penitentiary in Petersburg, Virginia, where he is incarcerated for a term of 2 years for attempting to destroy an Aegis destroyer at the Bath Iron Works in Maine 2 Ash Wednesdays ago.
I'd like to jump ahead to the Catonsville 9 action. One of the defendants in your most recent case, the most recent Plowshares case, was Tom Lewis Borbély, who was also a member of the Baltimore Four and also a member of the Catonsville Nine, and your action took place on the 30th anniversary of the Baltimore Four in 1997. But could you talk about the significance of the Catonsville Nine and how that was organized?
Well, a variety, without going into any details, a variety of us worked on it, and Tom certainly was one. He and I understood that we were, while we were awaiting sentencing for the Baltimore Four thing, to do another action would mean very heavy penalties. And the judge doubled up whatever he gave to other members of the Catonsville Nine. Lewis and I got 6 years apiece. But Lewis was a very, very stalwart character, you know, and he has been... He has been paying his dues for 30 years now, yeah. George Mishy was living with a group of people, furthermore, who were back from Central America, and three of them were Mary Novers, who had been kicked out of Guatemala. Tom Melville and his wife, who was a Mary Knoll nun, and then John Hogan, a Mary Knoll brother. And they were all ripe for the action. Mishy worked on them and got them to join the group. Well, we did a lot of recruiting and finally ended up with 9 people. The 9th one was a teaching Christian brother from St. Louis called David Darst, a wonderful guy, wonderful. So that was the composition of the group. We had only very, very limited meetings with one another. There wasn't the kind of intensity of planning that we go through today. Yeah, it was all very ad hoc, you know, which is to say you get ready to do something and you go ahead and do it. That was, we didn't know any better in those days. And we didn't know anything about preparing for consequences. You know, when the heat comes down, how are you going to survive, like when you're in prison?
Before we talk about the first Plowshares action that took place in 1980 in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, I wanted to ask you about the founding of Jonah House. Jonah House was founded when?
In 1973.
In 1973 in Baltimore. What is it?
It's a nonviolent, very simply, a nonviolent resistance community. We don't say one of our priorities is serving the poor, though we do an awful lot of work in behalf of the poor. For something like 23 years, we begged sizable amounts of fruits and vegetables and fish from wholesalers outside of Baltimore and then shared it with quite a desperately poor African-American neighborhood. So we did do that, and we did it twice a week, you know, for 23 years. And anyway, we hold all things in common. We practice voluntary poverty. We work with our hands to earn what we need for our living and our work. And that means supporting any effort towards resistance and peace. And it's been that way now for since 1973. The community has paid quite a sizable price, not only in actions but also in jail time. We speak of a revolving door between prison and what we call minimum security, which is living in this society. As you know, the prisons have this term minimal security. That's a camp right over there. That's Petersburg Camp, and that's a minimum security institution. This is an FCI, a Federal Correctional Institution, another level up.
So this, where you're incarcerated, is not minimum security. It's higher than that. Now, you're clearly a nonviolent offender, well-known by the courts and judges of this country. Why aren't you in the camp and minimum security?
Because of, for some aspect or another, I'm a security risk. Security risk, yeah. And because my chances for influencing others to the detriment of the government would be greater over there than here. Furthermore, I have refused to pay fines and restitution, and that's one of the things that would qualify you to go across the street.
Phil Berrigan, I've heard you say before that an act of resistance does not end with your arrest, but that the resistance continues in the prison. Could you explain what you mean by that?
We try to thrash out what we call prison witness. You draw a lot of lessons from what we experienced during the Vietnam War, and you wonder at how a movement was built up outside the walls, with all these young guys imprisoned who refused to fight in Vietnam and who were not interested in running to Canada or Sweden or any of those places. But the fact of the matter is that they were doing a hearts and minds and spirits thing. You know, they were influencing their own constituencies outside, which is to say their campuses, their churches, their neighborhoods, their relatives, you know. So they were doing very, very valuable work and very often unaware of that. And meanwhile, the so-called movement outside ran into perhaps 50 or 60 million who at least dissented from the war, and a large portion of it too resisted the war. And that, of course, brought about the downfall of President Johnson. So this prison witness in American tradition, nonviolent tradition, has always been a very, very valuable and even central increment in the whole thing. People are not willing to forget that you're in prison and you have voluntarily sacrificed your physical freedom. I do perhaps much more good here than I do outside, and I work fairly solidly, as all of us do, against war and all of its pomps and circumstances. So Dorothy Day, for that reason, said, you know, we have to fill up the jails, and you have to have the faith and you have to have the sense of justice and the decency to do that, you know. And it strikes me that we won't get far in this country until we begin to force the poor out of jail by coming ourselves.
Philip Berrigan is our guest, and we're in Petersburg, Virginia, at the federal penitentiary, where Philip Berrigan is incarcerated. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and no, don't worry, we're not finished yet. As soon as stations identify themselves, we'll be back to continue this discussion. Stay with us.
For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the war, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese sky.
This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. We're in Petersburg, Virginia, where Philip Berrigan is incarcerated at the federal penitentiary here. Let's move up from Jonah House in 1973 to the action you took in 1980, which was really the founding action of the Plowshares movement that you, your brother, Dan Berrigan, and others founded. And this was the King of Prussia Plowshares action that took place at the General Electric plant in Pennsylvania. Tell us what you did then.
We had friends up in Media, PA, that had been demonstrating at plant number 9, General Electric, for about 2 years, and who were pretty expert in judging what was being done there and how it was being shipped to the Pantex plant in Amarillo, Texas. So they suggested that the prophecy of Isaiah might be implemented there, and it was a completely new idea to us that we would be expected to take the initiative when the government wasn't willing to do that and beat swords into plowshares, beat nuclear weapons into scrap, you know. Completely new idea. But, you know, you're dealing with some rather intrepid people, and we decided we'd do our best to do it. We knew nothing about the guts of the plant, what the layout was. John Shuchard went into the lobby to the front of the plant once and investigated a phone book, an in-house phone book that was there. And he ripped out what was at least several years before, a tentative floor plan. And that was the only guidance we had. In any event, we tried to go in with the workers at about 7 a.m. Two of our number distracted the guard in the vestibule of the plant. And then others filed into the plant proper and I think faith has a great deal to do with always finding the weapons and always doing what you intend to do to them, because they're so anti-human, and because the God we try to be faithful to is all about the human. We say God is a God of compassion and justice. So we always find the weapons, and a group that is determined to find a weapons to do it nonviolently and to reduce them, always find them. And it took us about 10 seconds. John Shuchard went into a non-destructible testing room there, and there they were. You know, and we were going in like blind mice, you know. So we began to work on them immediately, and then it broadened out a bit, and we were pouring blood on classified blueprints, and we were destroying tools that had been specially made to work on the Mark 12A. This was a final testing room where they were judged functional before being packed and shipped to Amarillo, Texas. So anyway, we disarmed two of them, before security and some of the workers burst in on us, and at that point we dropped the hammers and stood for arrest.
How many Mark 12A nuclear warheads did you destroy?
Two. Yeah.
And then there was the famed courtroom scene. In fact, Emile D'Antonio made a film of this, and you all played yourselves. Only the judge was not played by himself, but by Martin Sheen.
Yes, we shot that in 2 days in a church in Manhattan, New York City. Yeah, in fierce August weather, I remember Martin Sheen sweating under a judge's robes in about 110 degrees of heat, actually.
Now, Phil, tell us how it was that you came to be kicked out of prison after your arrest at the King of Prussia.
Well, we determined to stay in order to work out this business of prison witness. That was one factor. And then, because we realized that you only, middle-class folk like ourselves, only identify with the poor when you're in prison. That's it. Not outside. You know, we can always go to a clean bed and to decent food and so on, as the poor can't. So we were working all of that out, and one of our number, John Shouchard, was a lawyer, and he began to work with one of the jailhouse lawyers. And they began to pry prisoners in that jail away from the clutches of the courts across the street, because the jail was right across the street from the courthouse, the Montgomery County Courthouse. And these prisoners resolved to fight their cases, which meant trials. And the clones across the street did not want to go to trial. Too much work, too much paperwork, too much expense, blah, 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 blah. Too many lawyers had to be called in, you know. So it got to the point where we became intolerable just by taking measures like that.
Initially, following your arrest, the authorities hadn't set any bail on your head. And then, you know, as this trouble started to go on in the prison with you guys working with the other inmates and with a jailhouse lawyer, magically a dollar amount appeared on your head. And then slowly that was reduced and reduced and reduced until finally the authorities came to you and said, you don't have to pay anything. You don't have to sign anything. You don't have to agree to anything. I just want you out of my prison.
It amounted to that. They refused to set bail on Dan and myself because I guess we were recidivists, and the others $250,000 apiece.
And there's a famous picture of the four of you sitting by the side of the road with all of your belongings, mainly legal papers, your boxes, waiting somehow to be picked up.
Yeah, Elmer Moss had 10 boxes.
Well, Phil, back to a more serious subject. As President Clinton very nearly took us to the brink of war not too long ago, a lot of resistance was going on around the country, and I've heard you talk about what we need in this country is the moral equivalent of war.
Well, the philosopher, I guess it was William James, the American philosopher, wrote this brilliant essay where he said, you know, we'll end war when there's a moral equivalent of war, which is to say all of the energy and genius and money and everything somehow has to be matched on the other side of the ledger with moral investment, you know. And just to give a simple example, when a young guy goes in the military service, he can be sent to far-off lands, he can be sent into war, he can risk his life, he can lose his life, and what have you. The risks for peace are negligible here in this country. Americans have a terrible fear of losing their physical liberty, a fear of jail. And there's a whole rhetoric, a whole a volume of purple language passed on about what a horrible place jail is and so on. As though good, solid, middle-class, well-educated folk could not put up with jail as well as poor people do. In any event, this some thought has to be given to this moral equivalence of war, because so much of what is wrong in the world is traceable back to us, you know, and we have to be responsible for it, you know, and we have to find out what the James's moral equivalent really is and then implement that.
Philip Aragon, the prison authorities have just come over and said that we have to wrap this interview up. You're 74 years old. You've served more than 10 years in prison for different actions at different times.
A little bit less than that, Amy. It'll be about 9 years when I finish this one.
9 years. Some might say, well, what has it accomplished? And especially that image of using a household hammer to pound a nuclear warhead. In the end, isn't this really just symbolic?
Well, it's also real, you know. And some of our friends, of course, get charged with enormous volumes of damage simply because they're dealing with highly technical stuff, very sensitive stuff. It's also real. But we have to avoid maximum destruction, because you have to preserve the symbol and what it can say to folks if their listening is cocked, if they're hearing. And the symbol of the hammer, or the symbol of blood, because they're both universal elements, says very, very simply, we all have a responsibility to do this. We disarm, see, or we die. We die. Gandhi used to make that clear. Martin Luther King did. We've been saying it repeatedly. My brother, myself, and other friends for 30 years now. We disarm or we die. We can't coexist with these weapons much longer. That's fairly predictable, you know. So that symbol which says that has to be preserved. And you can't get into an orgy of destruction, because the destruction becomes the issue and not the symbol of disarmament. We're very scrupulous about that. Very scrupulous about that.
Phil Berrigan, as we approach the 30th anniversary of the Catonsville Nine, that fire that you and your brother Daniel and seven others burnt in that parking lot with homemade napalm in 1968 still burns today with you as you continue your nonviolent nuclear resistance. How far have we come since the Vietnam War, and where do we go from here?
Well, as they say, military-wise and, even domestically, regarding the shape of the country, things are going from bad to worse. You know, life in this country is becoming more and more ugly to begin with. Outside of the recent uprising against threat to Iraq, people were pretty dormant. They were pretty dormant. They were hiding behind the woodwork. And a great deal of confusion is present about whether anything can be done at all. And that's a product of the way we live here in this country. It's a product of lifestyle. It's a product of disinformation coming from the government. It's a product of moral confusion because the churches and the synagogues, see, and the media and the campus are not doing their work. And so Americans are more and more helpless. Are more and more helpless. I don't know. To anyone thoughtful, and I think with their eyes open, things are rather dire. Very, very serious. The economy is booming. The Dow Jones is up, but that does not disguise what is really happening in our slums and so on.
What are your plans after this, Phil Berrigan? After you've served your time, perhaps you'll get out in November of 1998.
Well, it's not too productive to plan, Amy, you know. What you do, I guess, is hit the bricks, as they used to say, and start to listen to people who have been living with this mess for quite a long time while you were locked up, and then to plan with them. Do real communitarian work, you know. In the Catholic Church, we come from a tradition of community, a lot of it fraught with defects and bad philosophical approaches, what have you, you know. But it's still there, and we need to build on it, because that's what Christ did as a first public act. He built a community. For us, this means a nonviolent resistance community.
What do you say to the authorities in this country who have repeatedly labeled Jonah House your home, your community of your wife, your three children, and other activists who live together in Baltimore, who have called it a hub of criminal activity?
Well, of course, that's nonsense. That's nonsense. That's strictly their definition. More than anything, it just shows their ignorance of what today's world is and any measures taken to heal it.
We want to thank you very much for joining us. The prison authorities are here, and they're waiting to take you away, unfortunately. What will you do now when you leave us here in the visiting room?
Well, there's a count at 4 o'clock, and then I'll go for the evening meal.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, and it's been a pleasure to spend this day. We're proud to be here in the Petersburg Federal Penitentiary with Phil Berrigan, longtime anti-nuclear activist, the first Roman Catholic priest to be imprisoned for his political beliefs in this country. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our director is Jeremy Scahill. He's also my co-host today. Errol Maitland and Joe Gill are our engineers. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, today from the Petersburg Prison in Petersburg, Virginia. Thanks for listening. In a thousand different fights, I was there at the little big war. I saw many men lie, and I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the war, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it? From the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. To the war, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I